I don't see anybody, so I'm way down on the list.
Right.
Just hold.
Wow. Well, I would think, well, you're, how old are you? Or is that something that, don't you qualify from that?
Yeah, but that's where you wind up when you're in San Diego.
Really?
Yeah, Ed needs to check into the nursing home. Pronto.
We can check in just briefly, get our shots, and then...
I'm sure there's a way to go in for a couple of days.
Rather go to medical school.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's appropriate.
All right. Jill, how are we doing?
I think we can start.
Who are we missing? Michael's not on.
That's true. Sometimes we don't get Michael during the week of Hanukkah, though.
Well, he didn't respond that he wouldn't be on, so.
Yeah, it's not Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not a big deal.
Hello, Michael.
How are you?
Doing all right, you?
It's a little crazy here, but we're doing good.
Did you get vaccinated? Michael, did you get vaccinated yet?
No, we expect to get the Moderna vaccine on Monday, and we hope to vaccinate 3,500 people in 2 weeks. That's the crazy part.
Wow.
We're sort of racing against time because we're losing a lot of staff right now.
All right, so I think most people are on. So I wanted to start today. Bill Dunty has some announcements that he would like to share with CFAS, and we probably have some questions for him as well.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, so I just wanted to share with CFAS, we're starting to spread the word on these two funding opportunity announcements that I think came out last Friday. They're focused on supporting research that advances FASD interventions and prevention approaches to reduce prenatal alcohol exposure and the incidence of FASD. They are using unusual grant mechanisms. They're not the typical R01 or the R21. So I would encourage you to look at both announcements. The first one uses the R34 planning grant mechanism. And that's used when you want to look into pilot or feasibility, pilot or feasibility research. And that's a three-year award, whereas the second one uses the R61, R33 hybrid mechanism, which is a phased award. And that's where the first 2 years of the award is a technical development proof of principle phase. And if you meet certain milestones, you will be administratively allowed to proceed to the R33 award, which is a three-year award at a much larger budget. And that phase usually lays the foundation for pursuing larger efficacy trials or clinical studies. So take a look at the announcements. There's contact information at the end of each announcement if you've got any questions. Let's see what other point that I want to make. There's for both applications, preliminary data is not required. I would direct you to the announcements to see what research topics are covered. I am happy to report, if Ken's still on there, that there is some language regarding stigma and prevention approaches for stigma in the announcements. So.
Yeah, I'm very happy about that too, Bill. Thank you for bringing that up.
So these are, however, for I mean, there's not a set submission date, right? They're just regular, they go in at regular times?
They have three times a year submission dates. The open date is, I believe, January 2021.
And will they be reviewed with a special review, or are they going to go to a regular study section?
Yeah, good question. So these are PARs. So the R stands for special receipt or review. These will be reviewed at NIAAA at our four standing study sections. And they have special review criteria that the applicants should be aware of.
And could you provide a little bit more information about the distinction between the two types of awards here? The two mechanisms?
Yeah, so the R34 is a planning grant. So that's really, I guess, focused on certain types of science, social behavioral science. It's also intended to allow people to have a 3-year period where they can try to plan for and develop, pilot, if you will, a intervention or a prevention approach that then will develop into an R01 application. The other one, the R61, R33, is more for, it supports biomedical, behavioral, social science research, but it's in a phased approach where you take the first 2 years and you try to, is a feasibility period. And then that project then turns into and translates into kind of a clinical evaluation phase. The budget during that phase is $500,000 a year. And so the budgets between the two announcements differ greatly because of what I think can be accomplished in those projects.
Any other?
Hey, Bill.
Yeah.
It's Jeff.
Yep.
Quick question about the R6133. With NIMH, they use that mechanism a lot. And one of the things they focus on is beyond just feasibility is signal detection. Is that framework kind of being adopted at NIAAA in terms of demonstrating some sort of a signal during the 61 phase and then that being one of the criteria for moving on?
Yeah, Jeff, good question. Yeah, if you look at the announcement in particular, there's some language that suggests states what could be covered under that R61 phase, not just a proof of principle. So I believe that is covered, but you and I should probably double check. Yeah. Again, Ed, one big distinction, that R61, R33 announcement has specific milestones that the applicant has to meet in that first phase before we allow them to proceed into the last 3 years of funding. And so it kind of allows us to make the decision whether something is going well or not before we invest more money in it.
Any other questions about these proposals? I think due January 15th or something.
I think it's February 15th.
Yeah, and it'll be around for 3 years.
They
expire in 2023. And I will say that we've been listening to the community on in terms of funding and the importance of interventions and prevention science. And so, this was probably a year in the making, and hopefully people will find it interesting enough to apply to. So please send in your applications.
These 6 or 12 pages?
Good question. I think they're 12.
Any other questions? I mean, is this like something that one could partner like with NOFAST for a prevention type of?
Yeah, I don't, I believe it's
nonprofits.
Correct.
Any necessary limitation to foreign sites, though?
I believe foreign sites were eligible.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bill, any word on UH2s by any chance?
We are making some progress on the UH2s, but no official announcement as of yet. Sorry.
All right. So we have a very limited agenda today. And basically we just had our semi-annual meeting. So we're kind of up to date on where people are, but I just wanted to share some things about how this pandemic increased the amount of innovation towards science and getting work done despite the limitations of not being able to see people in several settings. So there was, and some of you have already seen this, from the Healthy Brain and Child Development Study, they have really tackled this problem, I think, really quite well. And I just wanted to share with you some of the things that they're doing. So I am gonna share my screen. These are videos. And we'll go here, and I gotta press those two things. Share, and then I need to move this over here. So what can you see now? Hello?
Yeah. Very little, that's very blurry.
Yeah, make it full screen if you can.
I just did.
We can see it, but it's a little blurry.
Hey, Ed.
It's not showing this full screen.
Ed, yeah, you go down to the right. Do you see the double arrows that are opposing one another? Yep.
Okay. Now is it better?
Better.
Yep.
And I think, you know, there's been a rich history of taking NIRS, EEG, and other methods out into the field, but MRI has been a bit more challenging. And the reason for that is when we think of MRI, this is what comes to mind, right? These large scale systems, they're several million dollars plus another $1 million to site, huge infrastructure needs, huge electricity needs. You have cryogens, you have technicians, you need huge power to drive them, but you get really beautiful data. But as a result of all those needs, they're really restricted to either hospitals or to really cutting edge imaging centers. And so, again, this kind of goes back to our problem of how do we get people from the areas that we're interested in collecting data from into these systems. And so certainly there are mobile systems. This is what tends to come to mind, right? These big 18-wheeler trucks that wheel up to the side of a hospital, plug into a large docking system at the hospital, and can do PET or 1.5T MRI. I think there's a few 3Ts out there. But this isn't necessarily mobile. Right, and trying to get one of these into Appalachia or into some of the tribal communities that we've talked about is going to be really challenging. So what can we do? Well, there's been this recent renaissance, as it were, in these low field MRI systems, really bringing in the idea of doing really quite pioneering and high quality neuroimaging structurally at very low field. So not at 3T, but down at 64 millitesla. And the difference between those obviously is the infrastructure goes away, right? And the cost and the power requirements, right? So you kind of get an idea of the power requirement differences between say a GE Premier or a Siemens Prisma being what's required to power a nuclear fast attack submarine, moving down to an espresso coffee maker. And so your major challenge in the morning is figuring out whether you want coffee first or your MRI scan and which one you should plug into the wall at the same time. But we've been using this technique. I think we were one of the first groups actually to scan an infant using the Hyperfine system. And we've been playing around with this for about the last year. Again, this was one of our consortium's goals, really to push the idea of remote novel MRI collection. But again, this is still in our lab. But if we look at the data, you know, yes, it's not your high-end Siemens connectome scanner or Prisma scanner, but it's on par with about a 1.5T system. And so the question then is that good enough to get out into the community and actually acquire data on a range of kiddos, particularly when we think of the cost-benefit ratio. You know, when we think about these systems, you know, the cost per scan is probably closer to about $50 as opposed to $1,000, right? So the scale there becomes quite different. But the real question is can we actually put this, can we take this to a home, right? And this is something that I broached Michelle a couple months ago and asked if we could try, and she was enthusiastic. I think she probably thought I was crazy. But we thought, you know, can we take a Ford Transit van and can we put a scanner in there? And can we move that to a house and actually do remote MRI scanning? The idea here really sort of pushing on a transit because you can get that anywhere on the world, basically. You can go over any roads, any dirt roads, into any rural setting. You don't need beautiful, you know, you don't need a special license. You don't need anything. And I thought what we'd do at this point, really, is kind of give you a show. So we're about 25 minutes into this presentation, but I'm going to switch a little bit. Just a second. So I'm going to pop over here and turn this off. Turn that off and go on to video. So hopefully you can see me pop up here. Here we go. So hopefully everyone can see me. So what might be weird is that I'm not in a lab. I'm actually at a participant's house right now. So I'm going to put on my mask here and we're going to go out and we're going to scan someone. So we've actually driven our mobile MRI scanner here. And what I'd like to show, with your permission, is the first ever residential MRI stream that's ever been done. So I'm going to just turn this and head on outside, and hopefully this all works. So here's our group. And we have our participant down here. Lucas is going to hop into our scanner. Our scanner is right over here in our Ford Transit van. We have a couple people here. We're probably very close to Massachusetts state rules about how many people can be outside, but we're here. I want to show you the actual scanner just so you know, no tricks, but here it is, right? So we just have our MRI scanner inside of our transit van. We have some safety equipment that we'll talk about, and we're gonna get Lucas in there, and while he's getting scanned, we'll talk a little bit about how this system works. And what's going on. So he's just going to hop up in there, pop up there. And while he's hopping in there, we'll take a couple little seconds just to give an idea of what's happening here. So again, we placed the Hyperfine system into basically about a $30,000 van. Now the challenge, of course, that we run into is we have a 1,400 pound device inside a 3,500 pound vehicle that's traveling down a road at 60 miles an hour. Now, if you remember back to your statics and dynamics courses, that's good as long as the velocities of both of those objects is the same. When they become different, bad things start to happen. So yeah, all right. So next week, Lexi's going to go and start this scanning. So everything runs off an iPad, so we can just wheel up. We have either a hotspot in the van, or in this case, we have a hotspot with us. So our iPads are cellular. So we can just all good?
Again.
And you can hear the scanner going. Hopefully you can hear that. So it's scanning away. And maybe while we're here, so we've actually worked with an auto body shop in Providence. And unfortunately, Paul is not here. Paul from New England Collision. But they've worked throughout a couple weeks, really putting everything together. Again, really, really doing a lot of safety work and actually building this thing in so it doesn't rock as we're driving down the road. We can go over bumps and whatnot, go up hills, downhills, obviously be safe in case we get into an accident or someone hits us. So a lot of work, but also we wanted to have the flexibility. So right now it's in the van, but we want to be able to take it out, right? If we're going to, say, a school or to a community center, we want to be able to take the scanner out, move that into, say, a cafeteria and do some scanning there. So we've built it in so that everything is removable. Everything can be taken out with a self-packing forklift. So not a real forklift, but one that you can actually take with you. And everything is very mobile. We also happen to have on site, so we actually, because we're close, we're in Dighton, Massachusetts, which is just about
just a couple hours from Guilford, Connecticut, which is where Hyperfine is based. So we actually have Brian and his colleague here.
Come on in.
So yeah, Brian, you know, just a little bit of trying to do a thing in the background. So now the Hyperfine portable scanner is portable in two ways. Normally we wheel around hospitals or EDs, but we put in a vehicle so it can travel around the street. And I want to point out there are no cables going into the vehicle at all.
That's right.
The scanner is operating completely standalone inside. It's being powered by a lithium battery box pack that provides plenty of wattage for it. The scanner uses about the same amount of power as a kitchen appliance. And we haven't modified the scanner in any way. So it's still the same FDA cleared device that we put into hospitals and EDs and rehab hospitals. So and Eddie is one of our RF engineers. So he put a screening box around the lithium battery pack to keep that screen nice and well for the scanner. And Lexi is going to be showing you images as they come through. We reconstruct images as the data comes in.
Are those coming through? All right, so we have some images that are just starting to pop up. So this thing is actually collecting data as we go along.
Yeah, it's about 3.5 minutes into a 5.5 minute scan, and it'll update every 10%, and the images just get crisper and crisper as it gets more and more of the case-based data, and it reconstructs all the data it has at that moment. We offer T1, T2, FLAIR, and diffusion weighted imaging with ADC map.
Perfect. Yeah. And then as part of, you might be aware that as part of our group's larger initiative, you know, this is sort of the step one of really, you know, getting rural within the US, but we want to get rural globally. And so as part of our relationship as well with other, with both the NIH as well as the Gates Foundation, we're working on ways of maybe trying to get into different contrasts. Be it into functional imaging, not EPI based, but likely some sort of steady state based functional imaging, certainly into ASL, magnetization transfer. I think, Brian, I think you have some quantitative imaging, but that's an ongoing project that we're working on, but certainly thinking of getting into the quantitative imaging, which certainly plays back to my heart. But we're cruising along. We still have about 2 minutes to go. Our participant's doing well in there. He's just kind of hanging out. So again, a T1 and T2 scan takes about 12 minutes or so to acquire all told. So you really could imagine wheeling up to a school, running a classroom through in a couple hours over lunch, for example, and at the same time doing cognitive assessments in the background. So, So you can imagine, as I say, going into a school setting, scanning a series like a classroom, for example, and at the same time bringing along your RAs to do cognitive assessments. That's what will happen here after the scan is done. They'll go in and do a whisk on the kiddo, and then off you go. And like I say, for a fixed cost of a system, so the van, the system, everything that goes along with it, as well as the people inside of it, for a break-even point of about 1,000 scans over a year, it's about $50 to $60 a scan. So it's not a huge amount when you think about it compared to your static system. And so with evolving improvements, we think we can get down to even cheapen that up a little bit if we can go faster. But certainly, you know, getting more and more crisp data, perhaps even taking a little bit longer. But
yep. 1 minute to go.
We're almost done. All right. We're going to start feeling like we're doing charades. All right.
Another benefit of being in the vehicle is the 5 Gauss line is essentially fully contained inside the vehicle.
Right. So that was the other thing I think that we wanted to talk about. So you can kind of see that hula hoop thing potentially at the top there. That is your 5 Gauss line, right? So everything is contained. So you don't have to worry about, for example, driving down the road and other cars becoming close to you. You know, your 1965 Chevelle, that's mainly metal, suddenly drifting close to your machine. And certainly don't have to worry about people with pacemakers or other implants walking beside the van, right? So we wanted to be obviously very, you know, careful and crisp about that. All right, getting down to it.
Getting down to it. Almost done.
Yeah, 5 seconds.
Okay, 5 seconds to go. And then we'll show you the first images. And then off we go.
Right, so let's open up the van a little more.
All right, so we can open this up. We get a sense of... Way to go, big guy. Good job. Our images are reconstructing. We'll get you those in just a second.
Okay, yeah, looking good. So of course, you know, like everyone, he's interested in seeing his brain, just like everyone else. All right, and we have a set of images. So we can kind of show you those.
Final stage of reconstruction. Takes about another minute after this exam ends. And
So we have a little bit more time, so we'll bring that back up. But in essence, there you go. You guys have all just been privy to the first ever MRI scan done at someone's house. So the idea now of actually bringing these things out, doing scanning, and we can kind of show you a little bit more if we hop in here, just to give you an idea. So it's an head-only system. You can put people in.
Oh, yep. Show the power source.
Here's our power source inside of here. So it is literally just some lithium battery ion. It looks really cool. Like everything, it looks just pretty cool.
It can run for another 3 hours.
So yeah, we have about 4 hours of scanning on here. If we want to, we can hook it up to a regular extension cord and continue scanning if we want. You don't have to go just off batteries, but certainly you can take it into any rural setting, for example, onto a tribal nation or even into rural Pennsylvania or rural, well, here, for example, and scan without a problem.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Yep, you're good.
I just wanted to cut that off. It goes on for another couple minutes and the images improve. But I mean, Bill sent me a link to see this because it was pretty amazing that they're doing this in the field like that. And so I automatically asked Bill for one. I haven't heard back from him yet. Whether he's going to give us $100,000 to set one up here. But
and depends on the van you want, Ed.
I wanted the Mercedes. But other than that, Jeff, if you're there, what are your feelings about this?
I cannot believe it runs off those batteries. It's insane. It's pretty cool.
You got plutonium in there, surely.
It looks like four of my lawnmower batteries, basically.
Did you see that before, that demonstration?
I haven't seen it, no. It's pretty impressive. And I imagine, you know, those volumetric data or those structural data are going to be fine for doing volumetrics, you know, if you get good motion control. I don't know about diffusion. Diffusion is, especially things like DTI and the way that we're doing them these days, it's pretty sensitive to a lot of factors. So I'd be surprised if you could get, you know, let's say tractography or things like that out of it. But I'm surprised to even see that it works. So what do I know?
It seems like it would be really useful clinically in those rural areas, right? Where you need a quick scan on someone, you just put it in the back of the ambulance and pull up to their driveway.
Well, it just seemed to me that in these times when it's difficult to see real life, that having something like that met some needs. I, you know, particularly in rural areas, I could see it in the Ukraine and things like that. So it was just pretty impressive. And
I'm not sure we could get it into the Ukraine, given how hard it was to get the camera in.
Yeah, it's true, but there are always ways, you know. We got things into Russia that we weren't supposed to get in there either. So,
hey Ed.
Yeah,
I will say, you know, I know Tina and Claire are investigators as part of HBCD, but for those that don't know much about the study, it's funded by these planning grants. So this is an example of what planning grants can try to accomplish. Many of the investigators are pushing the boundaries when it comes to remote data collection. This was one example. There were some other examples presented for example, you know, at home EEG collection and monitoring.
I have videos of that if you'd like to see that.
Yeah. So,
and the crib sensor too. Tina can talk to you about that. That is really cool.
I mean, they have it's a commercial system for remote consent and sensing procedures that they're using.
We are.
It's called the Jiva system. You know, and I know that I don't know how compatible it would be with the online recruiting that Leah and Tatiana are doing, but I mean, it's already available. And so, I mean, I just think that there are a lot of opportunities with wearable devices, remote sensing devices, where people are really getting things done, even though they can't have direct contact with the client. So, I mean, I think that this idea of telehealth and is just exploding now. And, you know, CFAS needs to forward think about this and moving forward with what we do. So, any other comments? Does anyone want to see the EEG or the other demonstrations? Not a lot of smiley, happy faces. Comments?
No, I'm all smiles. I think the lesson here, I think, is not necessarily, you know, how might this imaging, this portable imaging thing, be used as a component for telemedicine, specifically with FASD. But the whole idea of thinking in out of the box in completely new ways about how to bring the types of information that you want to bring to bear for diagnosis, you know, and I don't know where you get these ideas from, you know, I mean, but to have some sort of an incubator of ideas where we can think outside the box and go in completely different and novel directions, that's the kind of inspiration I think that we're asking for in moving the things that you guys are already working on to move it to that next stage. You know, and I'm not sure where that is, but I think that's the lesson that we learned there. I mean, 64 millitesla, when, you know, the last time I was paying any attention to MRI, you're trying to build up bigger and bigger magnets and bigger fields in order to accomplish anything. I think this is remarkable.
What I was impressed, in fact, with looking at these 2 days of talks that they gave on the HBCD, was the interaction of industry and academia. All of these things seem to be a collaboration of an academic institution with a commercial institution who's developed a new product. And I thought that that was really pretty astounding and had a lot to offer, you know, since it helps reduce cost and you're using something that someone has a proprietary interest in getting out there. And I mean, I was just unaware of some of the things that they're doing. And these are people that some of them I know, you know, that are doing this. So, I just was impressed.
So these are the types of different types of input and talent and collaborations that we were trying to brainstorm at the annual meeting last month. You know, what other kind of talent can we bring to bear that can help move, you know, the E-tree to that next level, that can integrate these pieces of the facial analysis and Christy's app, you know. I think going outside our comfort zone and inviting, as you said, industry resources, Google Global Health, for example, you know, does an awful lot of innovative work on the global level. And, you know, I'm certainly not in a position to try to recommend what direction you go and how to do this. That's why I really think we need some other kinds of input to advise you all on where we're going next.
Any other comments? Okay. Leah, you have any updates from the Data Access Committee?
No updates, no new requests. I've done nothing.
Sarah, anything on publications?
Just briefly, yep. Let me show you, share my screen if it's allowed. OK. Okay, so we didn't have any concept proposals, and I know we just had a meeting, so it's not too surprising, but just a reminder that RSA is coming up, so you're probably submitting something, so don't forget to submit your concept proposal. We did have one manuscript submitted. Christy and her group submitted a paper, so we're looking forward to good news on that. I think it might have just gone in, though. And I talked about this in the live meeting, but I have the professional image, so I wanted to share it again. This is Julie's paper on infant cardiac orienting. And that's it.
Okie doke. Are there any new updates on any projects? Anyone have any new exciting data in the last couple of weeks? Any other news? Joanne, you're muted.
I just unmuted. So not exactly news, but last time we talked about trying to get a group together with Olivia, Michael Charnas kind of brought us together, Julie and me and my group and so on, to talk about sharing data and building on each other's data. So we did have one meeting to look, and of course Ed was involved in it, but just to let the rest of the group know, we did talk about the kidney data. There may be some part of it going forward on that. Also cardiovascular data possibly to share. And we are following up with Olivia specifically on the autoimmune data, which she hadn't planned to follow up, but she has a fair amount of data. And so working with her on that would extend both of us to look at some new data sets around the autoimmune disorders that they have in their data set. So just to say that that came to fruition and productive meetings, and I think it will be productive. We're gonna talk further in the new year with her.
Yeah, I think that there is certainly something there. I think that, the Australian data with the kidneys was done at age 30 when you'd almost expect to find very, very low levels of kidney abnormalities, and that we're finding, or people are seeing, any at all, I think is significant. And I think once the data come out from the Atlanta and Seattle and British Columbia parts, that, you know, you're looking at a low incidence, but a doubling of the rate is really significant.
And correct. I think
that's what you basically have right now.
Correct. When we can put all these data sets together, finish the recruiting of the adults with FASD in the three sites, I think that will be exciting.
Yeah, so, I think the adult health issues are significant and certainly worth continued pursuing.
Yep. We agree. And it's great to have other data sets to link into.
Right. But also, I think that whatever we find is going to open up some doors or open up some avenues for further research from a number of different angles. So I'm hoping that that'll be the function of that data set.
Right. Sorry, I omitted mentioning Claire as part of that.
Absolutely. I think it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Jen, did you have your hand up? No. All right. Any other comments? Comments from the SAB? Additional comments? Sarah Jo's looking pensively. Should I say anything? No. We can see you, Sarah Jo. You know that. All right, James? No. Who did I forget?
Dan,
there he is, right next to you on my screen. You're muted, Dan.
Muted.
No, I don't have anything to add. I shook my head about the same time John did.
Oh. All right. Joe Wang's not on. Bill, you have any other comments?
Just one announcement to share. Dr. George Kube wanted me to let you guys know, as part of the extramural community, that he is offering opportunities to talk science with him over tea. He's been doing this internally at NIAAA for about a year, tea with the director, and you just have to schedule maybe a 30-minute slot. As long as you don't talk about an upcoming grant, he's willing to chat with you about science. So I'll send to Jill his secretary's contact information if you want to reach out to him and have tea with the director.
I did that a couple weeks ago, and it was very interesting. George is always amusing and very insightful. And so I recommend people who have just want to chat. And you talk about everything, you know, from his orchard to what he's been doing. So, yeah, it's worth doing. Well, if there are no other comments, concerns, I guess we will end it. And anyone else? All right. Well, everyone have a great holiday. Stay healthy and safe. And I hope people start getting vaccinated and this thing ends sooner than later. So,
and may 2021 be better than 2020.
That's an easy bet.
Here.
All right.
Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.